Back with you, a very busy edition of Connecticut Today on Tuesday, April 13th. We heard from a UCLA engineering professor who is one of the folks designing at least one of the expected COVID applications or vaccine passports you may need to get into or out of your favorite arena, entertainment venue, or restaurant in the coming months. Brian Lockhart joined us from Hearst Connecticut Media and the Connecticut Post to talk all things Bridgeport. Holly Sullivan checked in the 4:30 segment from the Connecticut Citizens Defense League to talk about gun rights and some misconceptions she says people are getting through the mainstream media. And we started off the 5 o'clock hour with segments of what Governor Ned Lamont had said earlier today about a timeout for the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine. We've talked a lot about it on this show as a matter of being a news story. And if you hop around social media, you'll get a lot of people saying, hey, if they use these COVID vaccine electronic passports, if I have to scan something on my phone to get in somewhere, I'm not going to do that. There's no way I'm going to do that. Well, you know what? You may have to, and it may open society quicker. And joining us right now to talk about one of these types of applications called the iOpen app or the iOpen system is a engineering professor from UCLA on the West Coast. Dr. Vawani Roshadri joins us right now to maybe set us straight on the security of this, why people shouldn't go crazy. Dr. Hi, it's Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me on your show.
Are you surprised, Doctor, about the pushback that some people in some corners of society are saying, hey, you're never going to get my statistical, my current status of whether I'm vaccinated or whether I've tested positive or negative? Are you surprised at all at any of the pushback you're getting on this from not just your product, but in general that you're hearing from some people?
No, not surprised at all. You know, what I call is and what I observe on the social media, I have a strong background in dealing with data related to COVID and data related to many other social phenomena. And there's what I call a fog of the pandemic. Like fog of war, there's a fog of pandemic. There's so much information out there, not always vetted. And some people are genuinely concerned. But what we are proposing, so I work as COVID researcher for iOpen World.com in addition to my day job, and what we are proposing is something to empower people. So see, right now, the information about how to navigate the world post-vaccination or still continuing pandemic, that information is scattered all across. And these are solid, trusted information. Like zip code level, there are 1,700 different databases. If you want to aggregate zip code level COVID, daily COVID infection rates and in the U.S., similarly, there are 26,000 plus sites that are administering the vaccine. So one thing that users and people need is access to this information so that they feel comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. And the second thing is this data, whether they're vaccinated or not, can be so powerful in enabling businesses such as cruise lines, such as universities, such as entertainment venues to make their own decisions. See, right now, if they want to open a venue up, they, for everybody, right, the capacity is 10%, 15%, right? Now, within the guidelines of the CDC, within the guidelines of the local government, if you are vaccinated, then you don't need to necessarily keep that much of a distance. And so the capacity could easily be increased to 70%, 80%, depending on the organization, right?
Sure.
And people do want to get back in the economic and the daily life. So it's, to me, it's a common sense tipping point that's going to come. Some people would be worried, but that's normal. But majority, once they see the convenience of it and wants to find out that, okay, I can get started with my life again, then I think this resistance is going to die out.
All right, Doctor, we'll come back momentarily. Folks, by the way, if you want to check out the product and what the doctor is working on here, iopenworld.com, iopenworld.com. Because again, as our guest said, there is a argument to be made that if people would adapt to this and use this, and doesn't mean you have to use it forever and ever, but we could get back to what we want to do a little quicker. Doctor, hang on. The guest for a few more minutes is Dr. Vawani Rashadri. He's an engineering professor at the Samueli School of Engineering at UCLA. Traffic and weather together. More about COVID passports coming up on WICC. A lot of people in and about the Bridgeport area and Fairfield County, Southern Connecticut, wondering, hey, what's up with these COVID passport things I may be able to use or might be asked to use on my phone in the next couple of months? A lot of experts say, hey, well, the quicker we use those to verify your vaccination status or your test status, the quicker we can, you know, get back to this. One of the gentlemen who has helped design one of them, the Eye Open Pass, Dr. Vawani Rashadri, is the guest for a few more minutes right here on WICC. So, Doctor, let me ask you something here.
Sure.
Obviously, the main thing I hear on my show here is, okay, I may want to use this, but what's the security factor? You know, I am giving health information. Now, Doctor, for me, if somebody knows I'm vaccinated or not, I don't care. If they know I had my shot, I don't care. But there are some people who say, hey, I'm worried about my records being on some sort of an electronic database here. How would you address those fears?
Well, it's a very valid concern, right? But see, there are already existing technologies that are currently deployed to secure your personal health information data.
Mm-hmm.
So there are what's called HIPAA standards. And that has been around, you know, for a while. And right now, as we speak, you know, depending on when you request, like, you are the owner of your own health information data.
Yep.
And if you want to share it with a new doctor or if you want to go to another hospital, then this data gets transmitted. There are billions of these, you know, data bits that are zipping through our internet and our communication lines all the time. So there are procedures in place to make sure that this little bit of information, not about your other health information, just the information that you got vaccinated or you got tested at a trusted location. And then that pipeline going from the trusted location to your own app is not going anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that whole process, there are standard procedures, you know, and trust levels built into technologies right now, which can ensure you that.
So folks should be then, Doctor, you're saying, you know, unless there's some nefarious operation behind here, which I don't really think there would be. I mean, people are flashing around their vaccine cards online, you know, like it's a, you know, like it's a, you know, like it's a gold medal from the Olympics. I don't have any real fears about this. And so you're saying, you know,
that's why.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
that's why this app we have designed, right, has this authority to connect you to trusted sources. So you cannot just claim I got my vaccine, right? Or here is my card, put it into your app. You cannot do that.
Yeah.
You have to tell us where is the record, which trusted source, a government agency or Walmart or Walgreens, where you got vaccinated. And then the app connects you your identity, your phone, to that trusted sources, all through encrypted channels, so that there is a verification and every transaction is recorded, you know, and digitally certified, so that if there is ever any issue, then one can go back and check whether there was any kind of a fraudulent scheme or not. So it's very important. Right now on eBay, people are selling vaccine cards for $200, apparently.
Jeez.
That's what I heard.
Jeez.
You know, so you need a trusted, you know, which is verified by different agencies, different, you know, overseeing kind of organizations, which is what iOpen World has tried doing, right? Then it becomes a lot more easy for you to be trusted and then businesses to trust you. So it's an opt-in basis, right? Unlike government-mandated, you know, kind of a vaccine passport, these are really where American ingenuity comes in, right? Where the private sector puts up, there are 280 million plus adults in the U.S., mm-hmm. right? So you need multiple solutions.
And obviously, folks, then, doctors, should keep an eye out as to where the iOpen Pass is being used, much the way that New York is already on the Excelsior Pass. Now, the iOpen app dropped a few days ago, April 7th, right? Have you had any, what's the feedback been so far as maybe adopting your platform? How's it been so far?
Well, you know, I handle the engineering and the data integrity sides of the app, but our executive staff, they are working with Miami-Dade County, with Los Angeles County, checking out the backbone end-to-end, right? And so we'll soon get the results of it.
Excellent. You know, Doctor, finally, before we wrap it up, I would imagine it's got to bring you a lot of personal satisfaction that you or anybody else who makes any apps like this or systems that can help us open up faster, I would imagine you garner a good amount of personal satisfaction about that at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like empowering both the American citizens as well as the businesses, right? And allowing them to have an option to adopt, to verify, right? And use it if they find it useful, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Folks, check it out. If you're a vendor, maybe, or if you're a business that may want to use this, municipality, or you may want to download this, knowing that somebody near you is using this, iOpenWorld.com, all together, all one word, all lowercase, iOpenWorld.com. One of the gentlemen who designed the app and has tried to explain a little to us about security, he is at the UCLA Sam Weldy School of Engineer, Dr. Vawani Rashadri. Doctor, thank you so much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. And
go Bruins. Thanks, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Yes, exactly. Go Bruins.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. There you go. All right. So one of the gentlemen that put together one of the apps you may see. So maybe your favorite restaurant, your favorite bar, an arena, a local arena, a large stadium says we use the iOpen app for COVID verification. Well, he helped design it. The engineering department at UCLA. Things Bridgeport here. Never a dull moment. Joining us to try and make sense of it all, our buddy Brian Lockhart, covering Bridgeport, Hearst Connecticut Media, Connecticut Post. Brian, it's Paul here. How are you? How you been?
I'm good, Paul. Paul, nobody can make sense of it all. I will make an effort, but nobody
man.
Can make sense of it.
God bless. You know, you folks at the Post and Hearst Connecticut Media and me here doing this show, there's never a lack of stuff. Mr. Dunn gets 4 months today. He's older than the chief. They still have to pay back some of the recompense here. So was any of this maybe the length of the sentence, Brian, or not a surprise or not?
I think that the feds wanted to send a message here. Remember, this investigation has been going on for a couple years now. And while Mr. Dunn and Mr. Perez both argued that they should not receive any prison time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the feds felt otherwise. And I think the judge on the stand, they made some pretty powerful statements in terms of the culpability of these two gentlemen. You've got to remember, on the one hand, if you look at this, I can see how someone would say, Perez had this long career. He served on the force. What harm was done? He was a likable guy. He obviously had a lot of experience in law enforcement. But you got to step back and remember that at the end of the day, it does not appear that he was qualified to be the chief of the police department of the largest city in Connecticut, with a lot of public safety problems, a lot of internal departmental problems, a lot of opportunities where there are reforms that perhaps could be made to how things are done. And so, there is a certain amount of uncalculable damage, I would say, that is done when you put someone who is not qualified to do the job of police chief in charge. And I think that's the message that the feds and the judges were trying to send here.
Interesting, because, Brian, you hit it on the head there. I did have a few callers yesterday and today who sort of brought up the same thing you just did. Said, listen, yes, AJ made a mistake, but he was on the force. He gave 3-plus decades of his career, and there are far worse criminals out there. But as I guessed yesterday, and as you just said, I do really think, and I agree with you, Brian, it looks like the feds wanted to say, hey, that's all fine. We get that, but we have to send a message here. I think you're right there.
Yeah, yeah. So no, I don't think that the sentences were surprising. Sad, yes. I think anyone who knows both of these gentlemen, I mean, I certainly, in my capacity as a reporter, worked with them over the last few years. I got along with both of them, in a professional capacity. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can't help but sort of feel badly about the situation and badly for their families and their loved ones. It's quite a fall. It's just quite a fall for these two men. They could have retired and had sizable retirement and lengthy careers behind them. And to end it like this it's a sad situation.
That's rough. You could step away. You've got your pension, go fish, go play golf, enjoy your family. Sure. Now, I also, Brian, got a call yesterday. Invariably, when stuff breaks in this story, they all say, hey, I had a couple of calls yesterday. They said, hey, of course Ganim knew. How could he not know? And I said, okay, I'll ask Brian when I have him on tomorrow. I know I've asked you this, Brian, a couple of times, but are the feds done here? I mean, I know I asked you that last time, and you said nobody's sure. Are we still not sure or not?
I can say for my part, I am not sure, based on the fact that no one on the city side has indicated to me that there is some sort of an investigation that is still going on, or that there is, that the feds are still around, that they're still asking for information. By the same token, the feds, which they do not do, they have not come out and announced we're done here. I think that there was a lot of educated speculation when Mr. Perez and Mr. Dunn were arrested back in September, that might be the first shoe to drop, and that there would be other arrests, perhaps based on whether or not, if they had additional information, additional evidence to provide to federal authorities. And if they did, and if they cooperated, would that impact their sentencing? The fact that they're getting prison time, again, I'm not an expert on this, but to me, it says that if they had a lot to offer, maybe they wouldn't be getting prison time right now. Maybe Mr. Perez wouldn't be going in for a year and a day. So I'm not willing to say it's completely over, because, again, these things take a long time. The original investigation into Mayor Ganim when he was first mayor in the late 1990s, that took a few years. Mm-hmm. And, again, this has taken a few years. So could it lead to other stuff? I'm not going to rule it out, but I cannot tell you definitively that I have any knowledge at this point that the feds are still interested. They're still actively looking.
Brian Lockhart is the guest, Hearst Connecticut Media, Connecticut Post, and all that. Brian, what are the other big issues that you guys are covering, guys and gals are covering the Bridgeport budget situation. I know a lot of people are looking at it. The money coming in post-COVID, where is that going to go? What's the update on that? What's your basic view on that story?
So the city's getting a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they're trying to figure out what to do with it. It is, you know, I mean, the pandemic was a horrible, horrible situation. And I mean, the cost in human lives and the cost in resources and material has just taken a horrible toll. The funds coming in from the feds are, you know, a bit of a silver lining, I guess, for a city that really has been beat up by the COVID pandemic in all sorts of ways, in terms of people who fell sick, in terms of people who died with COVID. But they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do with the money. The mayor presented a budget to the city council last week that reduces Bridgeport's very high mill rate of 53.9 mills. That's essentially the tax rate used to calculate your tax bill. Mm-hmm. Reduce that by 10 mills, which is significant. It brings it down roughly to what the mill rate was when he returned to office. And in his 2016 budget, when he had to hike taxes at that time, he blamed it on a property revaluation. They're arguing that they're now able to bring the mill rate down because last year's property revaluation was so good for Bridgeport because so many values are up across the city. Real estate values are up across the city. But they are still trying to figure out what to do with this federal money. You can't use it directly to lower taxes. You can't send somebody a rebate with this money, for example. You can use it to cover COVID-related expenses. They could use it to bolster social programs, education, infrastructure. So they're still trying to figure that out. I've heard a little bit of talk that there is some interest in finding some way to kind of poll the community and get an idea of how the community would like
this
money spent.
Wow.
If they're going to do that, how they're going to do that, I don't know. That was something that was mentioned to me the other week.
Yeah.
The 10 mil drop was not surprising. It had kind of been telegraphed by the mayor and his staff, I want to say late last year, when they were kind of announcing the results of the 2020 property revaluation. So that wasn't a shock.
All right. We'll keep an eye on all that. Brian, thanks. Always good to chat with you. Brian Lockhart, reporter, Hearst Connecticut Media, Connecticut Post, and all the Hearst properties in the state. Brian, thank you. We appreciate it. Take care, and I'll be in touch. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Always like being on.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Great stuff, Brian Lockhart. There you go. Well, 10 mil drop. Well, I tell you, people would love that, huh? I love that. Holly Sullivan stops in. Holly is the head of the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, CCDL, the primary advocacy group for gun owners in the state. Holly, hi. It's Paul again. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, and I understand you folks you were telling me the other day you're having a meeting tonight, right? Another membership meeting?
Yes, our first in-person meeting since COVID, so it's limited to the state restrictions. So there's free e-tickets on our website to make sure we don't go over capacity, but very eager to see people in person again.
All right, that website, by the way, is ccdl.us. Once again, ccdl.us for the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. You see the stickers all over the state, folks. A lot of active and very passionate gun owners in this state. So, Holly, let me get your and part of the reason I wanted to have you on was, you know, after these tragic shootings, which we can all agree are just horrific things, done more oftentimes than not by people who have some serious mental problems, you hardly ever hear that these were legal gun owners in good standing, NRA members, CCDL members, whatever. But what are your thoughts as to what you hear now coming out of the White House here as to some of these proposed gun laws that are currently being considered by the Biden White House?
Yeah, I think what's what's tricky about it is that I think that the average person that maybe doesn't have any frame of reference of, you know, being a gun owner, the impact of gun owners, they hear a very small explanation of a much larger process, and they go, "Oh, that makes sense," but they're not hearing all of it, right? So when you actually talk to somebody and you explain, okay, so here's what a law like that does to a law-abiding person, more often than not, they go, whoa, that wasn't my understanding. You know, so when we hear this term common sense, and we hear that all the time to a point where you almost, you know, it's hard to even really think of it as common sense when you hear what it does to the average American that chooses to own a firearm. So I think there's just a lot of dialogue that needs to be had. And I think that, unfortunately, the summary of these bills is not thorough at all.
One of the things that was highlighted in something the White House put out there, Holly, is a term that people may have heard, and I've tried to explain it to them, with the prevalence now of these 3D printers and people who obviously are not doing things legally, you have this theory of ghost guns. But do we know, Holly, I mean, are these unregistered, non-serial numbered guns, have these proven to be a real definitive problem or not?
I have not seen any data that's showing that ghost guns are a significant amount of crimes being committed in America. I haven't seen a statistic that shows that. What's interesting is I was doing an interview. I want to say it was with WFSB, but it was one of the primary cable shows, and the interviewer had mentioned that the Waterbury police chief had also given an interview and stated that these guns are showing up, and these guns are already outlawed here. So to that very point is, if the police are seeing these firearms showing up and it's already unlawful here, it just goes to show that the simple piece of legislation does not work. So point proven, just because on a piece of paper you say it shall not be allowed does not impact a criminal. Who does it impact? It impacts the law-abiding gun owner who says, I'm not willing to risk my family, my livelihood. I can't do that.
Holly Sullivan is guest. Holly, hang on. We'll be right back with you. We'll take a quick break. Holly Sullivan is the guest. She heads the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. I know there's a lot of CCDL members out there. You see the stickers on trucks and vehicles all the time. They stick up for the law-abiding, stress, law-abiding good gun owners, the men and women, thousands in this state. Holly, back to you momentarily. First, traffic and weather together. 4:36 on Connecticut Today. Holly Sullivan's with us for a few more minutes. She's the head of the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, ccdl.us, online if you want to check them out. Maybe you want to join or find out what they're about. They are the top group in the state for legal, law-abiding gun owners who want to unify in a group and make sure their concerns are heard, especially in this supercharged political atmosphere. Holly, one of the things that drives me crazy, and it must make your head explode, but I'm just going to vent on you here, I hope you don't mind, is anytime we see one of these tragic shootings, and even people in the media, Holly, who should know better, they refer to some of these guns that, again, are tragically used in these shootings as weapons of war. And, Holly, will you please explain to my listeners that nobody in the U.S. military goes into war with an AR-15?
Right, yeah, they would be super ineffective. So a lot of folks, unfortunately, and this is, again, as you said, as a result of the media spin, so many folks think AR stands for assault rifle, and that's just simply not the case. It's an Armalite rifle, which is a platform that's been around since the 60s. It has a lot of uses. It just happens to look very similar to other modular platforms. And one of the primary differences that a lot of folks don't understand is just the fact that they're a single shot, right? So gun owners here in Connecticut and around America, when they buy an AR-15 rifle, just a regular AR-15, they pull the trigger one time, one projectile bullet goes out. In military-grade weapons, that is automatic fire or at least burst fire, where it could be set to 3, it could be more, whatever, that's the tactical decision of the military. But most situations are not going to be very effectively fought with a single semi-automatic rifle like civilians here have. And it is such a misnomer that these are military-grade weapons. Just because it looks similar does not mean that it functions the same way.
Holly, let's talk about the whole scenario here regarding background checks. First of all, a lot of politicians always refer to what they call the gun show loophole. What is the situation on that, for especially for people here in Connecticut who, again, Holly, for whatever reason, they may not understand what the whole deal is? Explain that if you can.
Yeah, so what they're talking about is private transfers. When you go to a gun show, what they're talking about is the gun show loophole is not what's happening within the four walls of the gun show. So when you go to a gun show and you purchase a firearm from an FFL, you fill out the exact same paperwork as if you were walking into their shop. The same background checks are being run, you know, here in Connecticut, the same paperwork, the DPS-3, everything is done exactly the same. This gun show loophole that they've created a name for is essentially individual parties meeting in the parking lot of what could be a gun show. It could be a Walmart. It could be a park. It could be anywhere. What they're talking about is private transfers. They're not talking about, you know, it's mind-blowing, because when you actually explain that to somebody, it's like, no, when you go to a gun show, you're actually filling out the same exact paperwork as you would in a shop. And
yeah,
like, but I thought there was a loophole.
That's what I've been...
What they're talking.
Yeah, that's what I've been told, Holly, and I'm not a gun owner, but I've had many people tell me you just can't walk in and buy a gun differently at an organized gun show than you can from a gun store.
Right, and it's such fear-mongering, and it's so sad, because they come up with terms like assault rifle, you know, weapons of war, gun show loophole, and people are terrified. They go, oh my gosh, how can that be? It's not true. It just simply is not true. What they're trying to do is make it so that folks who happen to meet up in a place like a gun show, for example, but could be many other places, can't transfer a gun from one individual to another individual without a background check. It has nothing to do with the gun show itself.
All right, that's good. I wanted to clear that up. And finally, Holly, you know, you hear about, you know, enhanced background checks and all this. Now, I think a lot of people might not understand how, yeah, it may be easier in some states than others, but for example, here in Connecticut, and I know in a lot of states that frankly have a lot of urban gun violence, it is either nearly impossible or a multi-week process to actually get that gun. Now, for example, Holly, if I walked into a licensed gun retailer in the state today and I said, hey, I like that Glock, I want to go pistol shooting, so I'm going to buy that. And I plunk down my $700-$800, whatever. Okay, then what happens? So take me through the fact that Paul just bought a handgun on Tuesday, April 13th. What generally happens?
Right, so first of all, you cannot buy it without a permit. Right now, the process to get a permit, you're very likely, you're lucky if it happens within 6 months. So if you're not already permitted here in the state of Connecticut, you cannot even buy a bullet. You need to have a series of background checks, even to buy a single one little 22 round of ammunition that's worth about, I don't know, 30 cents in today's market. But so the reality is that process must have started months prior. So what would happen is you go to your local police department or municipality and you get an application to get your permit. Your municipality then has 8 weeks to turn that around. A lot of folks in the state don't get it within that 8 week period, and that's a shame, and that's something that we're very keen to keep an eye on. Then from there, you need to set up an appointment with state police. Again, you might be waiting another 8 weeks if you're lucky, and then you go to state police. And this is all assuming that your fingerprints came out perfectly the first time, you didn't get called back for anything, there was no issues along the way, and this is a perfect streamlined system. So now months have gone by, and now you would like to go buy your first gun.
Mm-hmm.
A law-abiding gun owner in the state of Connecticut is going through 5 background checks. So 3 of them happen at that municipal level when they first submit their application. The next one happens at the state level when they pick up their card. And then you want to go buy a firearm. Guess what? A background check happens again
Wow.
at the point of sale. So there is no one in the state that is a law-abiding gun owner that is just walking into a store because they're angry and they are going to have a bad day. That's not how it works. It just isn't how it works. And you know, it's a shame because, you know, when we talk about a lot of these statistics, two-thirds, keep in mind that of all these statistics that they talk about with gun violence, two-thirds are suicide. So a third, and I'm not saying that this is a good number, but one-third of all these numbers that you hear, these are the true, like, what I would consider to be, like, crime statistics, or mm-hmm. it could be, you know, a police-involved shooting. These are all of those things. But reduce that number that you hear by 60%, because we know that suicides are two-thirds of what they're considering to be gun violence. So, no, people are not just getting angry in the state of Connecticut, having a bad day, going and getting a gun and doing something terrible. It just doesn't work that way.
No. Holly, thanks for explaining that. Appreciate it. The website ccdl.us, ccdl.us. Holly Sullivan heads the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. Holly, good luck at the meeting tonight, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. Appreciate it. Holly Sullivan. There you go, folks. I just wanted to make sure that an authoritative person told you that.
Good afternoon. Josh Jabal and Deirdre Gifford and myself just participated in a conference call with the White House COVID Task Force. That's led by Jeff Zients, includes Dr. Lewinsky from CDC. It includes Dr. Fauci of Fauci fame and some of the other experts who are leading the COVID response on behalf of the federal government. As you can imagine, the pause in distribution of J&J until they investigate some of the side effects was a prominent piece of the discussion. Dr. Lewinsky said, of course, we want to err on the side of caution, a turn of phrase that a lot of us have been using over the last year. I think you should get some comfort from the fact that, early on they used to call it Operation Warp Speed, as if they were trying to get vaccines out as quickly as possible with some risk of cutting corners. That's not the case, and that's certainly not the case with the CDC, and that's not the case with the efficacy and the safety of the vaccines that are out there right now. Let's say there have been 6 severe side effects out of 6.8 million J&J doses that have been administered in the United States over the last many months. That's a 1 in a million chance of having that type of a severe side effect. 1 in a million. That's somewhere in the area of getting struck by lightning, or probably a higher chance, as somebody said, of driving to the vaccination site, getting into an accident. But that said, look, I salute the CDC for erring on the side of caution to give everybody that sense of confidence. A number of the governors thought, though, that the White House team was a little naive when they said, this is just going to be a pause, and then we restart our engines. We're working really hard as governors across the country, and Josh and Deirdre and myself here, to give people confidence that it's the right thing to do to get vaccinated, now. It's a million times safer getting vaccinated than pausing or waiting. General Parna, who's handles the inventory and distribution of vaccine, he says there's been some pause and some inventory in different regions of the country in terms of people who aren't getting vaccinated, leading to some excess supply. That's not going to happen in Connecticut. I'm here to reinforce how important it is that you continue to get vaccinated. CDC is being cautious when it comes to the J&J. You know, Josh has got the Moderna and the Pfizer going out. It's out in our FEMA mobile van right now. Those, small yellow ice cream trucks that we had on the road, they're going to take a pause today just as we get more Pfizer and Moderna in there. No J&J. Good news is we're going to get extra doses next week of Pfizer and Moderna. So hopefully we're not going to miss a beat. And I don't want to miss a beat because some of you say, hey, here's one more reason not to get vaccinated. Yesterday, we had about a 3.8% infection rate, so that's good. We're staying within a narrow band there. But there's still 21 hospitalizations, 17 fatalities. Get vaccinated. You won't be one of those hospitalizations or fatalities. That's what I heard, Deirdre. What'd you hear?
Thank you, Governor, and good morning, everyone. Yes, to follow up on the governor's comments, just a few additional pieces of information for the public. First of all, we appreciate and understand that the announcement this morning from the CDC and FDA about a pause on J&J vaccine caused some concern. So I want to make sure that people have the facts and understand what this is about, what it's not about. What we are doing here at DPH with the governor's office and in partnership with our federal partners, and then what you can do in response to this news this morning. First of all, early this morning, the FDA and CDC together did issue a statement recommending this pause and distribution and administration of the J&J vaccine. They did that as a result, as the governor said, of six cases of this blood clot event called a cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. That blood clot has been seen in combination with a low platelet count. And the combination of those two things in these six individuals is rare enough that they felt that they needed to make a pause and do some more investigation. So in turn, the DPH this morning sent a notice out to our providers also recommending that they pause the use of the J&J vaccine, and also letting providers, healthcare providers, know that this rare event has been noticed and that there may be some different ways for them to treat individuals if they should see this. Of these six cases, we are not aware that any have come from the state of Connecticut. We have administered over 100,000 doses of the J&J vaccine here in Connecticut. And as the governor said, nationally, 6.8, almost 7 million doses of J&J have been administered, with only these six cases being reported. So that's very reassuring as to the rarity of this potential complication.